Nomoto presents American Presidents. George Washington. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava Voice. Running time, approximately 27 minutes. Under the weight of later monuments, it is easy to forget that George Washington began as a boy who learned to read the land before he learned to read the law. In the tidewater mornings of Virginia, the light rises off water and climbs through trees in a way that makes distance look like promise rather than peril, and a clever boy with a compass and a chain can turn that promise into a profession. Before any sash crossed his chest, before any portraitist cultivated severity in his eyes, Washington's education was geometry made practical. Bearings laid down in wet grass, blazes cut into bark, angles translated into property. That apprenticeship taught him two grammars he never unlearned, the grammar of terrain and the grammar of men. He learned that a ridge is a sentence with meaning for any army that tries to cross it, and that a neighbor's claim is a sentence with more than one possible ending unless the boundaries are made exact. He learned to move through rooms where gentility and appetite sat side by side, where a promise over a decanter could travel further than a writ in a saddlebag, and he learned to be patient with silence, because in a world without telegraph, silence is how people think. The French and Indian War scalded the lessons into him. Young Washington, ambitious enough to make older men bristle, discovered very quickly that paper courage and field courage are not the same metal. He watched a European army walk into the North American forest as if it were a ballroom, and then watched the woods teach it a new grammar with brutal clarity. He learned the taste of retreat and the sound a line makes when the men in it stop believing the order to hold will be followed by anything except death. He made mistakes he later wore like hidden medals, dispatches written too boldly, a position misread, a confidence misplaced in a commander whose methods were equal parts arrogance and habit. He did not quit. More important, he did not pretend that bravado could replace logistics. He saw that powder is a schedule, that wagons are arguments, that the difference between discipline and despair is often a clerk with his sums in order. The young provincial officer, who had once liked the feel of his uniform, learned to like the feel of responsibility more and the feel of praise less. It is not too much to say that he emerged from that first war convinced that most disasters begin in the mind long before they reach the field. When the imperial quarrel ripened into revolution, he therefore entered the room differently than the men whose weapons were pamphlets. He was not an architect of phrases. He was an architect of rooms that do not collapse. His appointment in 1775 to command an army that was more rumor than regiment looked, at a glance, like a concession to balance, choose a Virginian to reassure Virginians, choose a tall man in blue to lift New England hearts, choose a name that could be pronounced without scowls north and south. The choice turned out to be less symbolic than surgical. Washington's chief genius was to understand a country as a map he would have to cross again and again with men who had reasons to go home, and to understand Congress as a weather system to be read rather than conquered. He kept the army alive until the army could keep itself alive. He did this by learning to ration his anger, by learning to make thrift look like virtue rather than deprivation, and by learning to let time fight for him when powder and rations would not. The mythology that turns him into marble obscures the harder craft that kept him from breaking. He was a man who could think clearly while being hated, which is the prerequisite for command in any republic. His severity was partly performance and partly protection. He did not confide easily, because confiding is a luxury in a tent where the next letter might be an insult disguised as a request. He wrote with a lawyer's care, though he was not a lawyer, parceled his judgments into sentences that could be read aloud in a committee without igniting it, and he measured his own temper as if it were a scarce commodity to be spent only when a shock was needed. He understood that contempt corrodes the commander before it frightens the commanded. He disliked theatrical courage because theatrical courage gets men killed in neat rows that look heroic in a painting and look like catastrophe in the paymaster's book. He accepted that certain kinds of loss educate an army faster than certain kinds of victory, and he accepted that the country was watching him as a symbol even when he craved to be watched as a worker. Perhaps above all, he understood that the real victory of the war would be the army's consent to cease to matter. He never let himself fall in love with being obeyed. The resignation at Annapolis is therefore not an afterthought. It is the sentence that completes the paragraph. He laid down the commission not merely because he was tired, which he was, and not because retirement had become a performance he owed to Cincinnatus, which it had, but because he wanted to plant a habit so deep that even a lesser man would find it hard to uproot. The country did not need proof that he could win battles. It needed proof that he could refuse a crown. The small, careful choreography, the hand to the paper, the words pitched just above domestic conversation, the bow that belonged in a republic, taught the new nation the posture of civilian supremacy more effectively than any law could have done. It also served as a letter to his future self. If that self were called again, it would be called as a citizen, not as a Caesar. The Constitution that called him back did not define the presidency with enough detail to prevent a fool from imagining it small or a demagogue from imagining it his. Washington had to choose the distance at which a republic keeps its executive, close enough to be felt as real, far enough to be felt as impersonal. He understood instinctively that in a democracy, intimacy can be a kind of corruption. He therefore built an etiquette around the office that seems fussy to descendants and felt necessary to contemporaries. The levees, the weekly rituals, the insistence that social visits be distinguished from political audiences, the refusal to let the public house become a courting house, all formed a membrane through which pressure could be absorbed without bruising. He wanted an executive with hands, not a head of state with hands out. He wanted to be seen just enough to make the office visible, and not so much that he became a petition window for the aggrieved and the ambitious. He had to invent staff work as well as manners. The cabinet Hamilton and Jefferson came to inhabit was not required by the text. It was required by the country's geometry. Hamilton brought an almost frightening capacity to turn abstractions into instruments, assumption as a national bond written into the nation's memory, the bank as a circulatory organ rather than a vault, tariffs as a school for industry instead of a mere cudgel. Jefferson brought a lyric that the country needed to hear about equality and the rural imagination and the danger of consolidating appetites in a city's shadow. The two men were a match that could not be put out. Washington did not try to deny the heat. He designed a room where the heat could be contained enough to do work. He let disagreement sharpen policy and refused to let it become the policy. He made himself the spine that bent neither to Hamilton's impatient brilliance nor to Jefferson's eloquent suspicion, not because he distrusted either mind, but because he understood that a spine that bends to minds becomes a spine that breaks under factions. That refusal to flatter a faction is nowhere clearer than in his handling of the nation's credit. He did not know the doctrine the way Hamilton knew it. He knew the feeling of unpaid men and the price of a lost reputation. He had marched through winter's bought-on promises. He had written letters that turned hunger into patience by force of tone. He did not need footnotes to understand that a republic that cheats will soon be invited to borrow at a liar's rates and to trade on a beggar's terms. He asked Hamilton the questions he believed the public would need to hear answered. When he could defend the result to himself, he defended it to the country. He took the cost, Southern discontent, the birth of durable opposition, because he could not in his conscience imagine a republic trying to live on compliments. The Potomac bargain over assumption and the capital's location was not corruption. It was the kind of compromise that prevents ideals from starving to death. Neutrality, declared in a proclamation and enforced with the stubbornness of a man who had decided that the nation should survive its founders, deserves to be read as moral courage rather than as timidity. The country owed France sentiment and owed itself independence. Washington refused to turn sentiment into a mortgage. He protected neutrality with the slow machinery of law, customs officers told to seize prizes fitted out in American ports, federal courts asked to perform the unglamorous heroism of jurisdiction, citizens warned that a flag of convenience is still a lie even when the lie flatters your friends. He bore the slander that follows restraint as if it were weather. When Janet mistook enthusiasm for policy and tried to conscript American fervor into French ends, Washington let procedure do more of the scolding than rhetoric. When the newspapers, intoxicated by their own discovery of power, made his name into a chew toy, he resisted the human impulse to strike back in kind. He believed the executive should teach calm, because everyone else is tempted by heat. Jay's treaty is proof that he meant it. The document is a triumph that looks like humiliation and felt like prudence. It traded fire for time, the evacuation of the Northwestern posts, a mechanism for claims that turned private anger into public process, a grudging acknowledgement of American standing without the theater of a parade. It did not make patriots drunk. It made merchants solvent. Washington read it as a man who had seen towns burn to satisfy pride and soldiers die to satisfy haste. He defended it because he wanted the shipyards to be busy and the farms to have markets and the frontier to be governed by courts rather than by rumor. He allowed the Senate to hurt him and then allowed the state dinners to go on. He did not ask for love. He asked for ships to sail on schedule. The frontier is where his presidency speaks most painfully to the present. The Northwest Ordinance had written a handsome paragraph about rights in schools and the equality of future states. It had also written, in the space between its lines, a story of dispossession that no elegant pen could soften. Washington presided over a policy that combined negotiation with force in proportions that shifted with weather and with panic. St. Clair's defeat is the catastrophe that clarifies the problem. Weak supply, poor preparation, underestimation of native confederacies, a consequent rout that stripped the new republic of its illusions and its men. Washington's response, anger precisely directed, reorganization without theater, the selection of Wayne, and the insistence on method over bravado, does not redeem the bloodshed or the futures foreclosed. It does show a man who refused to let vengeance do the thinking. Wayne's campaign fought with attention to roads and depots and winter quarters, won battles that scribes later turned into inevitabilities. The Treaty of Greenville followed, a paper levy that held until it didn't, a document that made white hunger legal and native sorrow administrative. Washington did not live to see how relentlessly the levy would be overtopped. He knew enough history to suspect it. He chose order over anarchy because he believed the anarchy would kill more swiftly and teach worse lessons. That is not absolution. It is an accounting of how he understood his office's obligations in a country that had already decided to be larger than the promises in its best paragraph. When farmers in western Pennsylvania made liberty into a cudgel against law during the Whiskey Rebellion, Washington answered not with a speech but with boots. He put the militia in motion to prove that the government did not mean its statutes as suggestions. He then let the courts finish the sentence. He pardoned where example had already been set and punishment would have been vanity. He wanted citizens to feel the state's presence as discipline rather than as humiliation. He wanted the line between dissent and disorder to be drawn by a judge rather than by a musket. He understood that every republic contains men who confuse courage with refusal and principle with non-payment. He resolved to be clear with them once and calm with everyone else thereafter. His social discipline, the distances he kept, the forms he enforced, the way he insisted that callers be callers and petitioners be petitioners, was not the performance of a man in love with stiffness. It was a design choice made by a man who had learned, at councils of war and in the half-chaos of legislative moments, that the closeness people crave in politics often decays into the contempt people then use to justify breaking what they once claimed to love. He refused to be all things to all visitors because he wanted the office to be one thing to the whole country. He made journeys precisely to cut the capital's pretensions to size and to let distant towns believe that the republic saw them with its own eyes. He sat at table with manners that did not try to disprove slander with charm. He preferred to be believed later than to be adored now. The farewell address, written with Hamilton's steel and Washington's gravity, has been misused as a cudgel against any foreign engagement and as an all-purpose prayer for manners. It is, in fact, more exact than either use admits. It is a leaf held up to show the country where the sun will burn it if it keeps walking at the same angle. The way faction makes a man confuse a party's victory with the nation's health. The way permanent antipathies and affections abroad lead a small republic to mistake borrowed hatred for policy. The way debt can turn a free people into petitioners. The way it is easier to keep a custom than to repair it once broken. He did not write to disguise his fatigue. He wrote to dignify it. He did not write to anoint a successor. He wrote to withhold an anointing from the office. He left because leaving had to be a custom, not an accident. There is the matter of slavery, which no grown account can avoid. Washington profited by it, organized his estates around it, tolerated its routines, adjusted their cruelties when he could bring himself to look closely, and failed to destroy the system that enriched him. He moved late and haltingly toward understanding that the words the nation had adopted could not be made harmless by the distance between his parlor and his fields. He arranged in his will for the emancipation of the people he could legally free, provided for the elderly among them, tried to prevent the worst of the scavengers from making money on his compromises, and left unbroken 1,000 chains he could not or would not find the courage to break in life. He was better than some and worse than the words on his own lips. He did not hate the people he owned. He did not, in time, bring himself to live without the labor they were forced to perform. His afterlife, in the imagination, has often tried to square the circle by sanctifying reluctance. The honest verdict is plainer and more difficult. He built a country capable of abolishing the thing he could not fully abolish in himself. He carried his body as part of the office. The teeth, the infections, the constant petty degradations of 18th-century medicine, the sleeplessness that follows a day of being watched, the exhaustion of being the country's mirror while also being a person who has to dress, eat, and meet, all of it wore at him. He refused to make the public a witness to his weariness. He took long rides because the saddle offers a man of his temper a way to be motionless inside movement. He preferred the company of a few people who could speak plainly without pretending intimacy. He did not court confidence, he selected witnesses. He knew that even his sighs would be recorded, so he hoarded them. If this sometimes made him seem cold, it also made the presidency warmer than it would have been if its first occupant had invited the nation to climb into his moods. He made mistakes that survive his defenders. He underestimated how quickly parties would become a structure rather than a mood. He tended to read newspapers as malice rather than as a proof that the Republic had found a way to argue with itself in public without killing anyone. He could be slow to adjust when a personnel decision went sour, perhaps because he valued loyalty in others at a rate that undervalued frankness. He sometimes treated the critique of policy as insult and then took insult into silence. He could be persuaded by the familiar when the unfamiliar deserved a hearing. He was a creature of land and of ledgers and did not always see how quickly cities were teaching the nation new appetites and new fears. He was not imaginative in the way Jefferson was, nor surgical in the way Hamilton was. He was precise in a different way, about limits, about tempo, about the difference between urgency and panic. Those are not the virtues that fill orations. They are the virtues that keep institutions alive. What he made, beyond any particular statute or proclamation, was a vocabulary of restraint and a schedule for using it. He taught the executive branch to think of itself as a single instrument played by many hands. He taught the legislature, by refusing to be its courtier, that it could not turn every executive act into a referendum on the man. He taught the judiciary, by refusing to lean on it, that it could grow its own spine. He taught diplomats that the United States would answer letters in complete sentences and on time, even when the Treasury was a rumor. He taught the army that it would be paid and praised like citizens rather than worshipped like idols, which is the difference between a republic and its cautionary tales. He taught the public that a leader can be both remote and trustworthy, and he taught the political class that a leader can be both stubborn and teachable. The quiet miracles of his time in office are easy to miss because they are habits now. That the military has no memory of a man who refused to surrender power back into civilian hands, that the treasury can borrow at rates that do not imply charlatanism, that foreign powers, even when they sneer, accept that the United States means its letters, that executives leave office as a matter of course rather than as a matter of force, that opposition can be loud without being treason, that a national capital can host factional fury without becoming a permanent camp. These are achievements he would have called necessities and his critics would have called insufficient. They are the soil in which later achievements grew. They are also the reason that men far less capable than he could later occupy the office without wrecking it on contact. The last chapter of his public life, which he wrote by stepping away, might be the most instructive. He did not try to solve his successor's problems by correspondence, though he could not resist sending advice when the new administration's nerves threatened to turn disputes into a doctrine. He did not write as an oracle. He wrote as an old workman who has watched too many shops burn because a foreman mistook loudness for leadership. He urged patience where party heat urged purge. He urged dignity where fear urged theater. He avoided the vanity of being needed. When he died, it was quickly and without stage management, and the country that had learned to lean on his existence discovered that it did not need to lean on his presence. That is not the kind of immortality an ambitious man usually seeks. It is the kind a decent man earns. His house and lands continue to trouble and to teach. They are the record of a world that the words of the revolution could not at once defeat, the record of a man who tried to square duty to a country with duty to the people he owned, and who failed to find a geometry that did not deform one duty or the other. The estate shows the narrowness of his imagination where we wish it had been wide, and the breadth of his integrity where we wish it had been thin. It is right to feel the dissonance. It would be wrong to pretend it drowns out the music of what he built. If you want him as more than a statue, try to see him as he appears in the minute before a decision, standing because he preferred to stand, the paper on the table in front of him, the room neither grand nor mean, his jaw a line drawn against indulgence, his eyes not unkind and not soft. He will not speak until he can say the thing simply. He will not be hurried into a phrase he cannot later defend. He will cut away anything that sounds like applause. He will worry about the example more than about the headline. He will ask himself, very nearly aloud, whether the country will be more governable tomorrow if he chooses this way or that. He will carry the choice by himself even when a dozen men are willing to carry it for him. Then he will sign and he will leave, and he will expect the clerk to do the clerk's work and the messenger to make the journey, and the public to withhold judgment long enough to see the thing in motion. He is not trying to be admired.
He is trying to keep the building standing.
The longer you live with him, the more you notice that his gift was not charisma, but calibration. He put the presidency at a distance that made reverence unnecessary and insolence unprofitable. He made it possible to disagree with him without wishing the government gone. He made it possible to replace him without imagining tragedy. He brought a soldier's punctuality to a city that loved improvisation and a planter's long view to a nation that loved excitement. He chose the legal when the poetic would have earned louder cheers, and he chose peace when honor demanded a different costume. He carried the accusations and sent the ships. He took the slanders and built the schedules. He accepted loneliness as the price of not being owned by any party and accepted boredom as the price of not being ruled by any emergency. If all of this sounds smaller than the bronze versions of him, consider how much of your ordinary civic weather consists of the institutions he left in working order, the court that cannot be leaned on with impunity, the army that does not sit in council over the legislature, the treasury that speaks a language lenders respect, the exchange of power that looks like a ceremony rather than a siege, the treaty that is followed because it is a treaty and not because a sword explains it. We ask founders for miracles and then live in the miracle's plumbing. Washington tended the pipes. He knew that grandeur without drainage is a swamp. He made sure the place could carry water. There is a final symmetry worth noting. He began with lines on land, and he ended with lines on paper that became the country's second landscape, procedures, precedents, schedules, salutations. He was not, in the way we now use the word, inspiring. He was dependable. He was not, in the way we now measure charisma, exciting.
He was steady.
He was not a genius of invention. He was a genius of refusal, refusing the crown in the moment when crowns are tempting, refusing to let war decide policy when policy could prevent war, refusing to let friendship dictate where law must speak, refusing to let disgust with opponents turn into contempt for institutions. Many men can be brilliant. Few can be durable without becoming obstinate. He was durable in the way granite is. Not easily moved, occasionally inconvenient, and always capable of bearing weight. If you stand, in imagination, at the threshold of his presidency, and then at the threshold of his retirement, you can feel the same draft. He walks through both doors without taking souvenirs. He leaves behind a room that looks tidy rather than grand. He leaves behind a schedule pinned to the wall and a set of habits written in the margins. He leaves behind, above all, a shape that lesser men can inhabit without breaking it and better men can enlarge without distorting it. That is the sovereign achievement, to make a great office hard to ruin and easy to respect.